people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. Tonight I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my countrymen, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and falling down to be. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be warning. You're running down my countryman, you're walking on the fighting side of me.
When you're running down like country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program here on LightResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people. Of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia and New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and today we're going to play a question and answer session between South African videographer Jan Lamprecht and some Canadian truthers that occurred 2 weeks ago at the Truth and Justice for Germans dinner in Vancouver. And Jan was our honored guest, and here's some of what he said.
Following two formal presentations they did in Vancouver, Jan joined a group of us for dinner where we continued the discussion about South Africa.
When I dealt with black activists from Zimbabwe who were against Mugabe, those blacks would then come to me and they'd say to me, when they get to know me, they would be sitting and chatting like we are here. And those blacks would say, Jan, don't you Boers have lots of guns? We need guns. And then I'm like, no, we don't have guns. You think we've got more guns than we really have. I have no intention of giving them guns. But I've even had a member of parliament, of the Zimbabwe parliament, come to Johannesburg with a white man as his driver. And he came to meet me and he came to ask me for 2 million rand. And
how much is that in Canadian dollars?
You probably divide it by 10, so that's probably like $200,000.
Why does he want you to give him $200,000?
Yeah, he thought that I would be willing to support his campaign. And one of the reasons is because he knew I was anti-Mugabe. So he probably thought that I was like the liberals and also that I've got money, which I didn't have that kind of money. And if I did have that kind of money, I'd have much more useful things to do with it. Yeah. But it was interesting that he came all the way to meet me and to run this proposal by me.
But what a brash proposal.
What is the gun laws in Africa, like as far as owning and possessing a gun? Second question is, do you have a major gay rights thing going on in South Africa?
They're always trying to push the gay stuff in South Africa. So yes, they have it. Maybe it's not as powerful as here, but I know that they have been pushing a lot of gay stuff. So yes, that is also on the cards. The guns, the ANC tried to take our guns away as much as they could. Their biggest effort to get rid of our guns was, I think, round about 2005 or so, somewhere in the early 2000s. They went on a massive spree to try and stop us with guns. They went so far that they said that they introduced laws that were so tough on ownership of guns, and you had to, if you wanted like a weapon, just to protect yourself in a dangerous society, you have to write like a 2-page motivation of why you need a 9mm handgun that you can carry. You have to provide like lots of serious motivation for this. And they made it so difficult that, do you know, that about 93% of all gun dealers and gun shops went out of business.
Jeez.
It was that bad. And so until then, we had quite a lot of guns, and it was relatively easy. They tried every trick to disarm us. In fact, you know what happened? They also said that if we didn't renew our licenses, we would lose our weapons. And it was the one time, I must tell you, that the whites quietly, without anybody telling them anything, you had to go to a police station and you had to go through the long, tedious process of registering your weapon. And suddenly, all the whites, even members of my family, who'd had a gun that they'd maybe not even picked up in like 15 years, they went and they stood in long queues at the police station. They stood there, we stood there for hours and hours on end, and the whites just standing there patiently. You see like 95% of the queue is just white people.
Wow.
And all these whites were standing at police stations all across South Africa, and they were going there to register their weapons. There were some who did hand in their firearms, but the vast majority, even if they had a stupid old gun that they'd never used, they went and they registered their weapons. I'm told that there were so many applications that the government sat with rooms full of applications for gun licenses, that it took them 2 years to process all the requests for gun licenses.
Wow.
And then the gun owners and so forth took them to court, harassed them, fought them, and eventually after 2 years we actually got licenses for our weapons. So although they harmed the whole industry a lot and set it back a lot, the whites also generally did not just give up their guns.
Well, yeah, because the dirty trick they played here was we had this incident that was called the Montreal Massacre. There was this alleged shooting where, you know, some students got killed in about 89, I think, right? And then there was this huge outcry for the gun law. Well, what happened was people that could read between the lines of what the government was going to do were smart and they didn't register guns, because once you registered your gun, okay, you surrendered your rights. In other words, you know, most police departments have to have a warrant to enter your residence, right? Okay. If you had a gun, the police had every right to knock on your door and say, show me your guns, they had to be stored in the safe. So basically, you surrendered your civil liberties by having that gun law, right? And I've also heard stories where people have registered their guns to have a domestic dispute, like, no, you don't, I didn't hear that.
Yeah.
And right. You didn't hear it from me either.
Yeah.
No.
But I mean, that's wink, wink, yeah.
Yeah.
You know what I heard just recently, though, that Trudeau is coming out with a gun ban.
Yes, I heard.
You heard that, too?
Yeah, that's I heard
before
that.
Before the election.
I'm not sure.
Well, he's getting desperate. What he's going to do. But, you know, the point is, they said that it would cost, what did they say, about $20 million? Yeah. And they've got...
Your guns are largely not registered.
I'm just saying this.
No, an
ignorant person would have fallen for that scam, because, you know, you started to read between the lines, you were Police can come knock on your door at any time, yeah, and enter your house. I want to see your guns. And you can knock
because they leave your guns. There's no registry now.
There's no registry.
So there's no registry.
So I don't know there is no, is now. There's no guns registry in Canada.
So basically,
unless they're handguns, though.
Well, basically, yeah, handguns are registered, right?
Yeah, they're
handguns, not rifles and shotguns.
Right.
That's right.
Yeah. That's still not bad.
How can you get an illegal gun? Just how can you get a gun?
Go down to Hastings in Maine and
get one.
Yeah, how can you get
one? Now, let me ask you this. When you go to buy a gun at a gun store, you can go and buy a gun and you don't have to tell anybody you bought it. You just go to the gun store and buy it.
But where do you go?
There's no paperwork.
I don't know.
A license?
Okay.
You just have to
have a license. I got a license.
One
license for all your guns, or a license per gun.
You got like a dozen.
My brother always had a pistol.
You have one license for all your guns.
As a kid, you know, it was in the top drawer.
And basically,
so it's not a license a kid, per gun.
I would.
No, we have to have a possession license to own a firearm.
Unload it, click to click out.
But whether you own one or five doesn't matter.
Blanks.
On the back of that, it has a barcode.
I was an expert.
That scanned every time I buy ammunition or any.
Lewis used to have units called commandos. Yeah. This is where the original term commando comes from. It's a Boer term. And the farmers used to form themselves into commandos. So a couple of guys get together, let's say 5 or 10 guys, and they form a commando in an area. And so all the farmers had commando systems that they all participated in, and they protected each other. The government made the commando systems illegal and stopped them. And then the farmers said, but we need them because blacks are coming and shooting us. Government said, no, don't worry. That's what the police are there for. They'll protect you.
Sure.
So then they banned the commando system. The police do nothing. And the farmers get murdered. So now what's happening very quietly is some of the commandos are reforming legally or illegally. They don't care. The whites are forming them, and whites are forming more and more groups themselves. Yeah. And they're just doing it.
So it's just freaking, pushed it underground.
They've just pushed it underground. They're just going to freaking do it because they're just not going to take it anymore. But it gives you an example of the government will tell any lie in order to stop protecting you, and they leave the criminals to kill you.
Yeah.
And if it wasn't for the private security companies, we would be dead in huge numbers by now.
So who pays these companies?
Sorry?
Who pays the private security companies?
The security companies are paid either by businesses or private people like myself. Literally everybody belongs to some kind of armed response in South Africa. You have armed response, you have your alarm system is rigged up to the security company. The security companies are owned mostly by whites. Many of them, either the owners or high-level people in them, were ex-police. Many of them are Afrikaans guys, ex-police, ex-military, lots of ex-police.
Yeah.
Lots of the whites were driven out of the cops, ended up either starting security companies or becoming one.
Yeah.
And so now they do protect us, we just have to pay them. So and they maybe hire blacks. And do you know the private security companies have got something like 400,000 employees?
That's an army.
Yes, and they've got thousands, 400,000, the police in South Africa was like 170,000 police, and the army is about 60,000 to 70,000. We've got more private people in the private security companies than the army and the police combined.
Doesn't the government consider that a threat? I mean, if these guys actually mobilized.
Actually, some years ago, just a few years ago, the government actually did say that this is a threat. But these private security companies have also got so many semi-automatic weapons that they actually said that the private security company's income was something like 45 billion rand.
Wow.
And which was almost, I think, almost equal to the budget of the military or something. So the truth of that, so in South Africa, the way that we are kept alive is that these private security companies respond, they do the patrolling, and people just sign up for them. They are the ones who catch the criminals. When there are gunfights with criminals, they have the gunfights with the criminals. They catch the criminals. The police might pitch up later or not at all. Then they'll take the criminals that they've caught to the police and say, listen, we've caught these guys. will you please put them in jail or charge them? Sometimes the cops will, quite a few times, the cops might let the criminals go. But white people, and I know of instances in certain areas where whites were too poor to have private security companies, they set up their own neighborhood watches. They catch the criminals and take them to the police, and then the police might jail some of them. White people catch the criminals. The police don't catch the criminals. The police never even investigate a crime.
So what do you do with them once you catch some?
Well, the people, at the moment, people just take them to the police. That's what they do. Because they don't go and beat them or anything.
Then they let them
They've got to be careful. Look, there are a few things that happen that I'd rather not say too much about. But people do what they can do, but mostly they try and comply with the law.
So what does it cost you? Like, you know, what's the average cost for somebody to have private
security? Probably, in my area, where we've got quite lower costs, one of the cheaper ones might be about $50 a month. I think about 50 Canadian dollars a month.
Yeah,
and some might be higher, like $80 a month or so. But it's not bad.
So what's the ratio of, let's say, low crime rate, let's say, cops per capita? You know, like 10 to 1,000? I'm just throwing
a number. I can't tell you that offhand.
Yeah.
I can't tell you that offhand, but all I'll tell you is that they did also get rid of lots of specialist police. We used to have white police, especially Afrikaans police, who were top class in murder and robbery and stuff like that. They shut down all the specialized crime units. They shut them all down. They got rid of lots of cops. But then all those guys just went private and did things in private, and they just kind of take care of, things. All that happens in South Africa, the main reason people go to the police station is when you are robbed or something happens, you go to the police station so that you can write out your affidavit, get a case number, and you go to the insurance company to claim damages.
The only reason
the police exist is to do the paperwork.
Yeah, it's just for insurance. Yeah, they don't give a shit. I know.
They don't give a crap otherwise.
Yeah.
But at least that system sort of functions, and that system keeps us alive. I can tell you, if that system wasn't there, we'd be in huge trouble.
You'd move to Vancouver. You'd stay here.
So if I want to go to visit you as a tourist, is that a good idea? Or should I really do a lot of self-education?
Yeah, how do they treat foreigners?
Not too bad.
My cousin is there right now.
And you just got to be careful where you go. In most parts of South Africa, you're going to be relatively safe.
Yeah.
And you're just going to have to learn certain things, like always lock your car, always lock your doors and things. Not like I've seen Paul sometimes or other Americans stopping and they don't lock their cars. No, you've got to learn to lock everything.
We do that here.
Yeah. Well, if that's how you are, then that's
in Vancouver.
As long as you take certain simple precautions and you are wary of the areas you go to, then you're okay. Then large parts of South Africa, you'll be quite fine.
Okay,
you'll be quite fine.
So it's not much different than the United States and their major cities. And,
I think it's still somewhat. I think in terms of actual murders, the total number of murders in South Africa matches that of America, even though we're only about a sixth of the population.
Yeah, it's very high.
So it is still quite high, but it's not so high that we're all going to die and you're just going to get shot. You're going to drive down the road, someone's just going to shoot you. If you stay along sort of the more first world parts of it, you'll be okay.
Really?
Okay. I've had an American friend who went there last year. He stayed there a couple of weeks. He's didn't want to go to the urban areas. He went more to the rural areas. He loved it. He said he liked it. He even thought the attitude of the blacks was better than in America. So there are some things you will see that when the blacks and whites deal with each other, that they are quite civil to each other.
The Jews behind it that's causing all the trouble with the communists, was not the blacks themselves.
Yes, these communists, you see, these blacks have had their heads filled with all kinds of nonsense. These blacks believe that we are the cause of all their problems.
Yeah.
And, you know, that poisoned politics as something that's been created completely outside South Africa, except for the Jews and liberals and communists inside South Africa, who kept telling the blacks, you are so disadvantaged, they're treating you so bad, you must do this.
A lot of them don't buy it.
Same thing in the States.
Yes, exactly. Exactly, they are busy creating the problems for the whites. That they're working today on the problems that the whites are going to experience 50 years from now. You know, really, that's how these people operate.
Yeah. Long-term planning.
Yeah, I'm telling you, they come and they come and they labor. They come and create all kinds of hassles for people.
Yeah.
No, these liberals and the ideas that they spread, the poison that they put in the minds of these people.
That's everywhere, though. It's everywhere.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's always ended. Yes. And the white male, of course, is at the top of the list of the creatures to be attacked.
But behind it all is a Rothschild, Zionist, Talmudist. Keep reminding people who's behind it.
Well, we were in the southern states a month or so ago, right? So we went to do Louisiana, Mississippi, Tennessee, blah, blah, blah. And went to Martin Luther King's home, okay? And actually where he was shot as well, the hotel where he was shot. But it was interesting, and there's a guy named Dr. Michael Jones, and he's concerned that, he says, well, we were getting along so well, but they're regurgitating all this white guilt, right? And there's this one museum we went to, it's called a Tolerance something. What they did, I don't know if you heard about it, but it's in, I can't.
You would see that every single thing that you are taught here, that we've experienced something that actually negates that. And for example, these non-whites, these blacks, if they had a chance to fight you and to crush you, they would.
And the blacks?
The blacks.
Yeah.
Any of these other races, if they had the chance to crush you, they would. Yeah. And you must never forget that. They're always working on this guilt, and they're basing it on the fact that we've won. You see, we won, and the guilt is now on us because we didn't really... We hardly ever lost, but you never get to think about what happens if they won, what would they do? And you can see from their intentions and from the way they speak and from the times when they rule various places, you can see that if they get the chance, they'll be way more brutal against us than were to them. So never,
the irony of white guilt.
Yeah,
we're the
so don't just the think. Don't just think that you know that it's just a one-way street. If the others could, if they could win tomorrow, if they could kill us tomorrow and get away with it, they'd be dancing on our corpses, they'd be high-fiving each other, they'd be saying, we're so freaking awesome, and you never see them doing any guilt trips about their stuff. And in my talk, I mentioned the Matabele who killed 1 to 2 million blacks. And I mean, nobody ever says, oh, that was a bad thing.
Yeah.
No, where's the way guilt starts? Slave trade, right? That's where it all starts.
Especially
for you. I was just going to say, well, it starts with who?
No, they're not
the Mohawk.
But they do they do realize that the real threat is Aryan man, right?
Absolutely.
And
that this beast is the hardest to control of all.
Yes.
He breaks loose.
Yes.
And,
all
hell breaks loose.
And that's why we are such a threat to them, and that's why our extermination is absolutely critical.
In front of the stones, cooler in front of the stones.
Can you just tell me?
A little bit like that. That's cool like that, yeah.
Okay.
What about the fireplace?
Well,
I mean, our extermination is critical to their... To their plan, right? Just like it was 80 years ago when they won the second one.
And when the Aryan man breaks loose, the world trembles.
Yes.
Horses litter all across the world. They fear us. They know we are the most uncontrollable. I was saying to somebody that the white male is the top predator on planet Earth.
Yeah.
And he needs to be the lion that he really always was.
Sometimes I have my doubts, but...
You know something?
You know?
I'll tell you, when you are put under pressure, in many ways we actually need enemies. and enemies are good for us. It will focus us. It will have less time for nonsense between us when we have real enemies. I think it could be, it could in the long run be the healthiest thing that's happened to us.
Okay, so just carry on and give your little speech here or your insight to South Africa. From what you've told me so far, it's fascinating and that's it.
Well, the one thing I wanted to tell you guys the story of the blacks and the Jews and the strange thing I heard from the blacks. That is very weird. When I was working in the bank, before they drove me out of my job, I did try every opportunity I had to try and test the blacks to see if I could teach them about the Jews. Mm-hmm. And I tried all kinds of different things. And interestingly enough, the thing that freaked them out the most was when I showed them the stuff to do with circumcision and the weirdness of the rabbis. That totally grossed the blacks out. Even the blacks said, this is freaking crazy. And
this is the rabbi sucking the kid.
Yes, oh, yes, yeah. Yes. They were like men and women. They're like, what? They're like grossed out. It was like the first time I'd seen blacks really grossed out by this. And anyway, so I tried various things and I saw, okay, that like really hit a nerve. When I tried other things, it didn't mean much to them. But that was so creepy and weird that they were visibly grossed out. Anyway, so there was this one black woman that worked there that I knew very well. And then one day, sometime after this, she said she wants to ask me a question about the Jews. And the following is what she asked me. She said to me, is it true that Jewish fathers are the first to take the virginity of their daughters? So I said to her, this is a strange one. I said to her, where do you come up with this? Then she said to me that the blacks in the township are talking about this. So what I then thought afterwards, after questioning her, is that the Jews in South Africa are rich, okay?
Yeah.
And they have lots of servants. And I have wondered to myself whether the blacks may have stumbled on something that the Jews do that we don't know.
What?
That because she specifically stated that the Jewish fathers take the virginity of their daughters. And I wondered whether this was something that they picked up by being servants of the Jews. That there was something that they heard. And I want to tell you, to me, I walked away with the impression that there may be truth to this thing. We might not know about it, but maybe these blacks have stumbled on something. And she said that blacks talked about this among themselves. So I still think that there must be something that somebody somewhere must have seen or known, because I think it's very likely that they stumbled on it. A very bizarre thing. Even bizarre for those of us who know something about these creepy people.
Right? Yeah.
So that was the one thing I had to tell. So I think fire away with anything else that anyone wants to ask.
Well, I think with the circumcision thing you talked about, what I've heard is it creates the trauma. There's that hormone called adrenochrome that when the baby's in stress, the adrenochrome comes out, and that provides a rush. So the blood is being sucked there. You actually get, it's like an injection of an adrenaline rush. That's what I heard.
You mean for the rabbis?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not just ritual. It's actually that's part of the sort of called alleged benefit of it is that they get a chemical rush from sucking on the blood.
All kinds of weird things that they might know that we don't know, because we just aren't that screwed up.
No, but this is on video. You can actually, people can sit there and this is a bunch of blood. You can actually go online and you'll see the ceremony. You'll see pictures and even videos of this ceremony you're talking about.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I have a question about the accomplishments of Verwoerd. He was like the greatest prime minister in 1958 to 1966. I read he was going to have something like this Swiss canton system in South Africa. The Jews didn't want this kind of independence, so he was assassinated right in Parliament. He was stabbed to death.
Yes. Yeah, that was second assassination attempt. They were very determined to get this guy killed because he survived the first one. And that Swiss thing that you mentioned there, when I knew P.W. Botha, he specifically always was for a confederal system, and they always used the example of Switzerland, and I think Belgium also has it. And he later said to me that South Africa is a nation of minorities, and this is the best system for such groups, because even the blacks themselves have got their own animosities. So yeah, this is very much in thinking with Verwoerd. It's clearly the same concept. But I also think that South Africa is an artificial creation, basically of the British, you know, because South Africa was made up of two colonies that were British and two Boer states, two Boer republics. And the British just merged them all together after the Anglo-Boer War. They worked with the Boers and they got this agreement that they would merge all these four. And that's why it's called South Africa. It's kind of a funny name for a country. It's almost like a geographical name rather than anything else. But it's basically that kind of creation. And so the whole country's got all kinds of mixtures of people in it, including, of course, colored people who are half white, half black, because there was race mixing as well. So South Africa is a strange country. It's not an all-black country, although blacks have now become the majority, but it's actually not as much of a majority as in other countries where the blacks are 99% of the population or something. There is still a chunk of people that is not black, or if they are non-white, they're not exactly blacks.
How much truth is there to when Odessa was created after the Second World War? You know about Odessa. That's the program to move German officers and diplomatic people around the world that were fleeing after the Second World War. You don't know about Odessa.
No.
And there, quite a few of them apparently went to South Africa.
There were Germans in South Africa, and you can see from what is there that there used to be a German community. Okay. Most of those people have grown old and have died out.
Yes.
But you can see the remains of what used to be a German community. I can't tell you whether it was 10,000 Germans or more, but I've definitely come across, let's call it the remnants of these people.
Okay.
And there's actually a very interesting video where one of these Germans knew Rudel. I don't know if you know Rudel. Rudel was that pilot who was like a superman.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. He was an ace.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Now, Rudel, there's actually a very fascinating interview done with a German in South Africa who actually was in the same unit as Rudel. Okay. And Rudel, in his early days, was not actually very good. He was actually like the most retarded of the German Stuka pilots. And they were saying that in their squadron, he was so bad that when everybody else was making maneuvers, Rudel was like doing his own thing. And they couldn't understand why this guy is so useless. And they were moved, I think, to Greece and so forth. And then they were going to go to North Africa. And the guys were just saying, man, this guy's like the worst of our, like the worst guy on our team. And eventually the officers said, they're going to send him back for like final retraining. He's so bad that they're going to send him back and they're going to give him a last shot at training, because otherwise they're going to get him out of Stukas and the Air Force or whatever. He's so useless. And they removed him from the unit, sent him back to Germany. And then about a year later, they were fighting in Africa And then they heard about this guy on the Eastern Front, and the guy's name was Rubel, and they're like, what? Is that Rudy or whatever? And they couldn't believe it was the same guy.
Yeah.
And the guy said that he thinks also that Rudel had like a commander who was a commander who he got along with, etc. And now he was shining, and he was just unbelievable.
Yeah.
And I regard him as, I think the proper title for him is to say, I regard him as history's greatest super soldier.
Hitler wanted him as his successor, right? Hitler considered him as
No, that would be Goebbels. He was Navy.
Hitler was interested in Rudel.
He
was interested in him as a successor. Because he's so respected by the people he wasn't there.
I must tell you, I mean, if you look at what he achieved as a fighter, pilot, and the things he did, I mean, he's the greatest soldier in all of history.
He had over 500 tank kills.
Yes.
Tank
kills. Tank kills. And he sank a battleship. He did a whole bunch of stuff.
What
flipped him around?
Well, he learned to merge his body with the plane, right? Sometimes.
Yes, you're onto that.
Like an extension.
Because Rudel explained that. At the time when other people thought he was he was an idiot, he was actually trying to make the plane do what he wanted it to do. So they were teaching him how, but he was trying to figure out something himself. And the guy that they interviewed in South Africa, he also said that he thought that Rudel maybe responded better to his new commander. That maybe his commander treated him better, or he got along better, and now suddenly this guy was just shining. He was just unbelievable.
Sometime in the 1980s, Ernst Zundel had him in Toronto to speak at Zundel House.
Did you ever meet him?
Yeah.
Is there any recording of any of this?
I'm going to find out. The fellow who was at their meeting in Hamilton, who was Ernst's videographer, would know. I'll ask him.
Man, because if there's anything where Rudel speaks, that would be out of this world.
Didn't he go to Argentina after the war?
Yes.
Can I ask you a question about the Indians in South Africa? And of course, those are not the same as our native Indians or Red Indians.
Yes.
The ones from India. What's their role in South Africa?
Those Indians came to South Africa, as I understand, as slaves. The British apparently brought them in, I think, to work in sugarcane in Natal, which was a British colony. So they came in as slaves, and then I think later they were freed. And those people, they are the same people as the ones that you in North America call the East Indians. 100% the same people. And those Indians, they are, in South Africa, they actually are more like business people. They're into IT and all the, especially IT. But there is, of course, the whole issue of them promoting themselves. They're very much a closed group. Even the blacks.
They leave them alone.
Even the blacks say that the Indians are the most racist of all the people in South Africa. The blacks say that.
Is that?
And in fact, let me tell you another little story about South Africa that I've forgotten to mention. Do you know that in 1949, the Zulus became so angry with the Indians, because the Indians are mostly in Natal, where the Zulus are. The Indians were shopkeepers, and they treated the blacks badly. And there was a point at which, one evening, some Indian did something to a black child, the Zulus got so irritated by this that they started talking among themselves that they should start killing these Zulus. And within a few hours, they were going to kill these Indians. And so these Zulus, within a few hours, started attacking Indians and started killing them. And and word spread like wildfire, and the Zulus were starting to get stirred up about this. And this was in 1949, and the Boers then got wind of this, and it was Afrikaans police, etc., that dashed into Durban and started shooting the Zulus, and in so doing, they killed stacks of Zulus, and they stopped the genocide of the Indians.
So, the ethnic cleansing.
Yes, a full-on ethnic cleansing was starting off.
Interesting.
And the Boers saved these people. Now, these same Indians, of course, went and worked with the black communists. Yeah. You'll see lots of those Indians were in the Communist Party.
Yeah.
They were working with the ANC. Mm. Those Indians knifed the whites in the back full-on.
Yep.
I will tell you another little apartheid story about the Indians, is that in the Orange Free State, which was one of the Boer republics, in the Orange Free State under apartheid, it was illegal for an Indian to be in that province after dark. All Indians had to be out of the Free State by nightfall. It was a rule. So yeah, of course all these rules later fell away and so forth. But the Indians are very wealthy. They were very wealthy. Even in the 1980s, I remember once, I think they caught some Indians busy shipping 20 tons of gold, loading it on a ship to India. None of them really want to live in India, but some of them do have assets in India.
Sure.
But they will tell you they don't want to live in India. Why? Because life in South Africa is way better for them. But in terms of any kind of loyalty to the whites, the answer is zero. Zero, zero thankfulness or loyalty to the whites. They've flipped over and they've worked with the blacks, but the blacks actually don't really like them, especially the Zulus. They actually don't like the Indians. And just on that score, in Africa, Indians have been hated by blacks before and thrown out of black countries before. Indians in many ways are like Africa's black Jews. The relationship between the blacks and the Indians is very similar to the relationship between whites and Jews.
Interesting.
Well, following on with that, I don't really have a lot of antagonism against the black people. Like, certainly there have been problems with them like that, but like, they're working with the black people, like they're getting them to work for them and in their homes and all that. So it's not like a personal, I don't have anything personal against them. It's like,
in that sense, you're quite right.
Yeah.
When I grew up, you must remember that the vast majority of whites in Southern Africa were Christians. Even in Rhodesia, the people were Christians. But the Boers, of course, are more determined Christians than others. But Christianity generally was very prevalent among whites. And whites believed in Christian values. So the white view of blacks was that blacks are almost like our children, and we need to look after these people. And we can see their faults. We can see their faults and mistakes. And then like children, we say to them, no, don't do this now, do that. And that has been the relationship between the whites and the blacks for a long time. That they see them and they can even sometimes see their hostility. And then the whites don't even hassle too much about it. They just go and they just try and say to them, no, don't do this, you know, and calm down and do that, and this thing won't work. Whites actually were, you'll find that they've even used this term in books about the whites of Africa, that the whites had a very paternal relationship with the blacks. They viewed the blacks as like these children, because compared to us, they're like children. They don't think and plan and do and operate like we do. So when we see them doing stupid things, then we don't laugh at them. We try and help them. We say to them, no, stop doing that now. You know, come here, like you talk to a child. You know, come here, do this now. And that was the relationship with the blacks. And so,
of course, that's your undoing. That's
exactly,
your undoing.
Exactly.
That maternal instinct is very feminine instinct. Right, and that's like creating a monster. that's coming back.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We looked after them and we didn't even worry. I mean, among the things that whites in general did is the white race's presence in Africa allowed the black population to explode through the roof.
Yes.
Because whites who lived there, as well as missionaries, gave them medicines, brought them doctors. These things saved their lives in incredible ways. These people, their survival strategy has always been to produce lots of children because they have a high death rate. And then along come the whites, and suddenly the death rate of their children is very low. And so, but they still carry on behaving exactly the same way. So instead of their population just growing maybe very slowly, suddenly it just goes through the freaking roof.
Sure.
And that's what's happened to them in the last 100 years.
Yeah.
And of course, suddenly others came and saw, look at these white people.
Yeah.
They're being, the black population shooting through the roof. Why don't we turn these black people against the white people? Bang.
Also, and what about bringing them to Europe? There's so many. I guess we better bring them to Europe. We better bring them everywhere.
They can go everywhere. Absolutely.
Some to Canada.
Absolutely. And another thing about these blacks is even when they destroy things, who saved their lives? Like in Zimbabwe, when Mugabe seized the farms, Mugabe said that even if half of the population of Zimbabwe were to die, it would be all right. He said that this is so important that even if half of the population dies, it must be done. And half of that would be, half of 13 million would be 6.5 million. And he was ready to sacrifice 6.5 million of his own people.
Sure.
However, what then happened is that the world, the Western world, the UN and everybody came and gave food aid for years. They gave food to these blacks who should have perished as a result of seizing those farms.
Right.
And they fed them for years.
Yeah.
They fed them for years. Nobody died. Hardly anybody died. Only in the early months of the thing did a few die. But then that has completely disappeared. And there are many famines and other things that have occurred in Africa where the blacks could have died by the millions.
Yeah.
Probably the only one that really did happen is that one that I've given in my talk about Mozambique, where hundreds of thousands died. But otherwise, there are lots of famines that have been where blacks should have died, but where the Western world saved.
Yeah.
So we whites, those of us inside Africa and also those outside Africa, have played a role in allowing their population to explode while not taking care of ourselves.
Two points to make. What is the black family unit like in South Africa? And the second point I'll make is that it's funny what you're saying about they want to increase their reproductive rate. In the US social policies in the 60s, the government was looking to break up the black family. They actually incentivized black females to divorce. And encourage them to have, like the saying is, 9 children with 9 different fathers, the social safety net, i.e. welfare, will support you. But you'll be penalized if you stay in a stable relationship, but you know, working family and all that. So that's common knowledge here, maybe not to you, but what is a family unit like in South Africa for blacks, just by and large?
In South Africa, there are lots of black women who just have children from whatever fathers.
So
it's not that different.
Yeah.
And when they have children, they just give the children to their mothers and grandmothers, and they raise them anyway. Lots of black children are not even raised by their own mothers. So these people don't really care that much. You do, of course, now get those who've got a higher standard of living, who do appear to be a normal family. But their views on a lot of things, even when they learn our culture, and these blacks are very anglicized. These blacks are completely at home with the English language. And these blacks function within, these are almost like black-skinned Englishmen, okay?
Yeah.
But if you look at them closely, their behavior is still not exactly the same. Like, for example, even when they are married, From what I understand, even when they are married, for them to go and have children, to go and have sex with other partners, it's not a big deal. The men go and sleep with other women, the women go and sleep with other men. It's not exactly the same as wives. They're not exactly the same. How they decide to interpret their values is their business. Which
I'm not even sure we can understand what their values are.
My own view is just leave all these peoples alone. Yeah. Let them do whatever they want to do. And that is why I find it hard to believe that anyone, how they misrepresented apartheid as being anything other than as being oppressive is crazy, because in actual fact, apartheid, and even before apartheid, whites gave these people many chances to rule themselves. Do not think that the whites who lived in Africa didn't consider on multiple occasions allowing blacks to rule themselves or to rule something, or even to look after their own areas or suburbs. Whites were always looking at ways of using these people, and the methods that we eventually used are simply the methods that worked. Because, you know, if you had a black guy working for you, if you had some kind of scientific genius working for you for a few pennies, and he was capable of doing other things, you would have benefited from that. So if he wasn't that, if he could do more than the task that you assigned to him, if he was some kind of genius who could go and fix your vehicles or invent something for you, you would have allowed him to do that in many cases, because when whites employed them, they were trying to get as much done as they could. However, in reality, what the whites found was that these people, you give them certain tasks. I mean, I grew up on a farm. You give them certain tasks, and they just can't do that task, or they can't do that task accurately enough, or whatever. And so the reason you don't give it to them anymore is because you can't. Either you have to do it, or you have to employ someone specially. So the notion that you just want to keep somebody down is itself not quite true.
No.
Because in your normal day-to-day life, you're trying to get as much done as you can. People would take them, they would train them as drivers, they'd train them in different kinds of things, and they'd say, okay, I used that guy for that thing in my business, and he did this and this. And then another guy will say, and then he'll say, oh, he failed. And then another white guy will say, yes, I tried that too, and it also failed. And that is how whites actually came to using blacks the way that we used them. If these people were capable of a whole lot more, we would have used them differently. Or we might even have treated them as an enemy if we truly felt threatened by them. But the reality was that we never felt threatened by them. We actually saw them as incompetent.
Yeah.
And there were so many of them, and we were basically trying to see, what can we use them for that they are worth using for? That is what it was. And if you actually go back to a lot of colonial stuff, I've got some video footage of Mozambique where the Portuguese were. And you know, when I was a kid, when we employed blacks, we employed them on a big scale. You had white farmers who, a single white farmer could employ thousands of blacks at a time.
Yeah.
Like on tobacco farms and things, they could employ thousands of these people, and you'd see fields filled with these blacks. And I've got film footage from Mozambique where you can see some of that stuff. So we used them, and the reason we used them at these menial tasks is because that was the only thing that actually made financial and logical sense. It was as simple as that. Then, of course, you've got the communist and the liberal, and then they start with their nonsense, and they say, oh, well, you're not paying them enough. Now, the moment you start with that line of thinking, it leads to all kinds of new problems. Because now, if you pay him more, is he worth paying that?
Right.
And even in South Africa, where that process started in the 1980s, when they started considering those things, then you will see that the blacks have actually shot themselves in the foot. That in the 1980s in South Africa, even the big companies owned by liberals, owned by the elite, owned by the Jews, started using automation. Automation started kicking in the 1980s when the blacks were busy striking all the time. So you see all these big companies starting to employ less and less blacks and starting to automate more and more. And in actual fact, the process of blacks being removed from their work is a process that's continued from the mid-1980s right up to the present day. Yeah. Whites even employ less and less blacks in their houses. Yeah. These trends have been carrying on for decades. Yeah. The races, despite all the talk that, the races are coming together, the reality on the ground is that the races are going apart.
Yeah.
The blacks get rid of the whites when they can, and the whites get rid of the blacks when they can. And this process has been running for more than 30 years. Yeah. And I think this process will continue on. I don't think it's going to stop. And maybe all this trouble in your part of the world, you'll see it'll also kick off trends. So while the liberals and the Jews and the talking heads are telling you this thing is going to take you here, meanwhile it's taking you there.
Yeah. Question, rather than the generic comment about it's blacks versus whites, what about the infighting between different black groups? How many, would you say, black groups, tribes, I guess, in South Africa? And what's your attitude towards wanting to beat each other?
Okay, in South Africa itself, there are about, we've got 11 official languages, so each tribe speaks a different language. So we've got about 11 different tribes in South Africa. The thing that you don't see, but which a former military guy gave me once, is a map of the tribes of Africa. You've seen a map of the countries of Africa. And all of them have got the same boundaries that they had under colonial times. You will notice that none of the borders of the countries of Africa have changed after independence. They've all stayed exactly the same. In fact, the blacks have actually blamed the whites. They've said, because when the whites drew up these boundaries in colonial times, they cut across the actual places where tribes lived. So you get tribes where half of the tribe lives in this country and half haven't changed. And something that an old military guy told me was that the Organization of African Unity in 1963 passed a resolution that they would never change the borders of the countries of Africa. So even when the blacks are in control of Africa, they decided to keep the borders that the whites had set. And they've stuck to that. And I think that they've done that because if they start changing the borders, they might end up fighting wars. That's what I think the real reason is. But the bottom line is that nobody talks about it, and nobody ever points out that the blacks themselves agreed to keep the colonial borders. If they truly felt the borders were a problem, what stops them from changing the borders now? They've got the organization, they've got what they call the African Union. So if they decide the borders could be done better, why can't they do it? And you'll notice that they don't. They stick to these colonial boundaries. But I'll tell you something else, is that I've seen a map, and I really need to publish this, of the area of the tribes of Africa. Africa is about more than 50 countries. But the number of tribes is over 300. So there are 300 different black tribes in Africa. And that is those are the real boundaries of Africa. And one of the things about apartheid was that that's what this military guy told me. He said to me, part of apartheid was starting to redraw boundaries because the whites were creating Bantustans. And they were starting to create new territories for the blacks and, of course, for themselves. And if the policy of apartheid were to continue, then you'd start redrawing borders inside South Africa and later outside South Africa. So that is very opposite to, and you'd be redrawing borders according to the tribes and things. And that could make for a very fascinating